Sit back, relax, and raise a glass, for spirits coming from the past. Sip on salt while your skin crawls with your pre-haunting wolf having a ball. Troop was home at Washington Pool with guests and spirits in your favorite pools. Gather the others, no hesitating. The moment's approaching, it's now time to sing. Haunts and hearts, haunts and hearts, crack open the can and fill to the top. Haunts and hearts, haunts and hearts, this is your podcast and it's called Haunts and Hearts.
Tell us about APRA, which is the American Paranormal Research Association. It's a fascinating endeavor. You founded the entire organization, and I read up on it and, you know, followed it on Facebook and everything. It's about taking the scientific approach to investigation, which to me would help incredibly with skeptics. But what are the core aspects of what APRA does?
Well, you know, I founded the organization in 2006 to solely investigate historical locations throughout the United States from a scientific perspective. And, you know, my journey into the paranormal began in 1995. I lost my oldest brother to cancer. In 2004, I lost another brother to suicide. So that kind of sent me into my journey into the paranormal, if you will, and trying to find a possible existence of a life after death. So for me, I didn't get involved in the paranormal because I had an experience per se. It was more about having to grow up at a young age and really know that death is an inevitable part of life. All of us are going to go through that. But, you know, as a kid, I always thought, well, is there a next step? Is there an ultimate transition? So before I ever stepped foot in the field or started APRA, I, you know, got my hands on as much literature as possible, everything from psychic phenomena to scientific investigation. And I started reaching out to medical professionals, doctors, engineers, scientists, to help me remain grounded in scientific principle before going out and investigating with APRA. And I did so. I spoke to these people, comprised a panel of these professionals, and they helped me remain grounded in scientific principle to push this field forward, to be taken seriously, to really step out of the shadow of pseudoscience. And it's something I'm really proud of to this day.
Talking on that, so I know that you just finished the season finale of Ghost Hunters pretty recently, and you had some really amazing scientific discoveries. Are you allowed to talk about that? Do you want to touch on that at all?
Absolutely. I would love to. You know, that's one thing, like Ashley talked about earlier, with the paranormal community, a lot of times they look at TV as being, you know, fictional or as being something that's set up or faked. That was one thing for me. If I was going to get involved with Ghost Hunters, I had many meetings with A&E as well as the production company Pilgrim Films about going in and them allowing me to conduct my research. They contacted me to come and investigate the paranormal. And if that wasn't going to be the case, I just didn't want to be involved. So they assured me that if I was going to come on board, that they would allow me to investigate the way I've always done it. They love APRA. They love the mindset of APRA. And they like that it kind of took, you know, Ghost Hunters to that next step in the field, as far as not being TAPS, not being the original show, but creating a new methodology, creating a new style of research. And they afforded me that opportunity, which was great. And I called in a lot of favors from the scientific community, people I've known for many years, Dr. Harry Clore being one of them. I know Ashley's met him a few times. He's the only person in history to receive two PhDs simultaneously in any discipline. And he got that in physics and chemistry. And he's someone I've worked closely with for 10 years now, a decade. And I called in favors and yet again went to these people. I said, if ghosts are real, and they are manifesting from a scientific perspective, how would that happen? And they threw out the theory that there's a very particular matter that may be associated with what people perceive to be ghosts, and that's photon events. And photon events are all throughout the universe, right? They're light events that carry electromagnetic radiation, which is really interesting. So I was sent out a camera called an EMCCD camera, an electron multiplying camera, that is built by the digital imaging scientific community to record these photon events. And I took it into these haunted locations throughout the country, utilized it in locations that had a bunch of eyewitness reports, and we made some tremendous breakthroughs, not only capturing amazing imagery of things that didn't show up in other spectrums and other cameras, but we do know that there is a very particular matter associated with the possible manifestation of entities, and that is photon events. So now we're talking about the paranormal on a scientific level, and it's amazing. Very proud of it, and I can't wait to continue that research to really take that extra step to, you know, prove that these photon events are what people perceive to be ghosts.
And that's It's huge, not just for the paranormal community, but for the scientific community. Like, this is so groundbreaking, and it's going to be life-changing for a lot of paranormal investigators, because now, you know, there are so many people that are weekend warriors that just go into it for the fun. And now we have more substantial evidence showing that there's life after death, and we don't know how it works exactly yet, but now, like, there's something to base it off of, which is super big and hasn't happened quite this way before.
No, it hasn't. That's one thing that's really interesting. One particular image that I collected at Fort Stanton in New Mexico was this complete absence of light that peaks out of a doorway. It is in a humanoid shape. It looks like a person. But the beauty of this camera and using the EMCCD camera that records photon events is when I showed this to one of the consultants that I worked with for many years, he said that this is mind-blowing, one, because there should not be a complete absence of light. That's not how this camera works. And two, these photon events and that complete absence of light should not be created one image. It should be separate images. And for that to come together to create one image was mind-blowing to these people, and very exciting for the field.
Wow.
So essentially that was proof that there was some kind of anomaly there.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's amazing. Because, you know, I can use the camera. I understand how to set it up, how to run it. But when it comes to the analysis portion, I'm not a scientist. So I had to speak to scientists that really could break it down frame by frame and really tell me what I was looking at. And we captured some really amazing stuff, not only in Fort Stanton, but three other places in season two that really provided this huge breakthrough that we have now, that there's something to photon events and something to what people perceive to be ghosts.
Where did the idea come from to use the EMCCD camera? Because obviously I can't imagine it was invented for the paranormal specifically, but to have the kind of creativity behind it said, oh, you know what, that could actually work. How did that come about?
Well, again, I've, you know, comprised this panel of experts that I've been working with for many years, and I've reached out to, I think, four or five different people I've been working with for a number of years. One is a NASA engineer who talked about photon events heavily. Dr. Harry Klor is another person that's talked about photon events with me. And I really wanted to, you know, go down that road to really observe that. And luckily enough, I had a connection that had one of the EMCCD cameras, which is very difficult to get your hands on. It's solely used by the digital imaging scientific community. So they sent it out to me. They let me utilize it in my research. And we were testing a theory that if ghosts are real from a scientific perspective, we have to look at photons and try and record those photons in said haunted places. And that's what we did. And we had tremendous results.
And they were studying photons for, like, NASA was studying photons for what purpose? Was it, like, presence of otherworldly life? What were they using photon technology for before?
Well, the universe is made up of photons. So right. All throughout the universe, you'll see photonic events happening in different shapes and forms. But there is a debate in the scientific community that they think that these photon events may have a consciousness, which is something they've always talked about. And there's a really great interview with Dr. Primrose. I think Joe Rogan did it, but I think he's talked to other people where he talks specifically about photon events in the universe and how they believe there's possibly a consciousness associated with that. So the next question from a scientific perspective is, are those photonic events happening on Earth? And if they're happening on Earth in these said haunted locations, is that what we're dealing with? And I think that we're definitely onto something at this point.
So one thing I want to point out for anybody that has not been following Brandon and on his journey with Ghost Hunters, all of him pushing these limits are not a new thing. Like, he, since I've known him, every investigation we've ever done, he's always pushing the limits. He's trying new things that nobody's ever tried before. Now, I know, I respect it. I love it. I think it's super fantastic what you do, but Ghost Hunters fans can be a little bit picky. So how has that been received? Because I know I get messages a lot asking about why Grant isn't doing this and that. And so I know it's been a little bit difficult, and it's a transition because the fans aren't used to such a heavily based scientific show. And so how is that going for you right now?
It's been good. I mean, at first it was difficult. The whole first season, you know, I started to slowly implement the scientific perspective and the scientific methodology. And I started to do that by introducing, recording all the environmental conditions in locations. And that was something that was really pushed heavily in season one. I think something that's really easy from a scientific perspective for a majority of the paranormal field to grasp and really look at to see if there is a change in the environment in these locations, pressure, temperature, humidity, EMF, vibration, things of that nature. But then season two comes around and we kicked it up to a whole new level because Grant, you know, took a step back. You know, he had the team go out by themselves and I was brought into a new role where I was leading the team. And to me, it was all about implementing my methodology, my research, which I was afforded that opportunity. And I said, okay, if we're going to do this, let's go full bore. Let's really go heavy science, because if we're going to be taken seriously, we have to do this. And that's what we did. And once people saw the results and they saw the images coming out of the EMCCD camera, and then later in the season, you'll see that not only were we collecting these amazing images with the photon camera, but I started to pair that with data loggers and recording the environmental conditions. And we started to see a pattern where if there was a change in the environment in the room, we should expect to see something. And we actually did actually successfully have that in an experiment in Galena, Illinois, at the Galena Marine Hospital, where I set up a data logger in the view of the EMCCD camera. We started to see pressure changes. And 5 seconds later, lo and behold, photon events started to show up within the room. And that's taking that scientific perspective to the next level. So it's kind of a slow rollout, right? The first season, more about the environmental conditions, recording those environmental conditions, finding patterns within those, and then going a step further by trying to visually correlate that. And that's what we did in season two. So it started kind of slow, just kind of baby steps for the field. And then season two really just, you know, blew the lid off of it and kind of showed everyone what I've been trying to do since 2006. And it's just the beginning, because there's a lot more research to be done.
What I loved about your approach is, you know, over the past decade, many would probably consider Ghost Hunters to be the most credible ghost hunting television show, but you still were unsure. You basically told them, like, look, you're like your own general manager. Like, look, this is my style. If my style doesn't fit with your show, I don't want to do it. I give you all the credit in the world, because a lot of people would just be willing to jump on television, but you wanted to make sure that you had your approach, which you consider to be the best approach. So I think that's amazing that you know, that they accepted that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And Ashley's known me a long time, and I never had a desire to be on television. That was never my thing. You know, I've always been a behind the camera guy. You know, I've been a filmmaker for many years. I worked for ABC, CBS, Fox. So I know how that world is, and I know how that world works. So to me, I'm all about credibility and getting out there and doing proper research and really stepping out of the shadow of pseudoscience. I don't want to be involved with a gimmicky TV show, which almost 99% of them are that, right? I don't want to be involved in that, especially put my face on that, because that's my credibility. That's my career. That's my future. And if that was going to be jeopardized in any way, shape, or form, I would just rather do what I've been doing since 2006, no skin off my back, because I don't want to be involved with something that's, you know, not credible. So that was a big thing for me, a really make or break situation.
Now, I want to continue with paranormal stories, but you had such a good segue, I can't not do it. But being a filmmaker and always working behind the camera, Anastasia is so excited.
Crosser, I'm so excited.
We really want you to talk about Cemetery Park. Can you tell us about this, please?
Sure, absolutely. It was 2014. I moved to Ventura, California, and I moved to this place on Hemlock Street, right on Hemlock and Main, this old apartment building that it was the only thing I could afford at the time. I didn't have a lot of money, studio apartment.
I remember.
I moved next to this place. Yeah, I moved next to this place called Cemetery Memorial Park. I never really thought much about it. I thought it was just a name until I started talking to the locals around here, people that have lived here a long time, and they started to tell me that it was a cemetery. I thought it was oral legend, kind of a urban legend, if you will. And I started to do a little research on it, and I found out that there's over 3,000 people buried in what's now a dog park. And I started to look into that, and I found this man named Stephen Schlater, who's been fighting the city for 16 years now. I found out that the city did a very horrible, illegal thing in the 1960s where they demolished a 7-acre pioneer cemetery and removed all the headstones illegally. I was compelled to tell that story, and it's something I've worked on. It was an official selection of the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, which is one of the top five in the country. And it's a very heavy-hitting true crime story about the illegalities of a city that did things highly illegally and has never really paid for it. And hopefully this film is going to change that one day.
I'm so excited for this. Like, I just want to watch it. Like, and I've been telling everybody that That's how they're like, have you heard? I really have. I was like, have you heard about Cemetery Park? There's a documentary that you need to check out. I don't know how you're going to see it, but
So the question I have is, you mentioned in the 1960s, they did this illegally, and if 3,000-ish people buried in the cemetery there, were there not families that were completely outraged that this was happening, or were they just silenced because it was the 60s and you could silence anyone in the 60s?
Well, that's the interesting portion. You know, that's a big part of the film, is that when I first started speaking to Steve Schlater, he's the main, you know, figure in the film, I thought the guy was a conspiracy theorist. The stuff he was telling me, I was like, no way someone could do this and get away with it. There's no way. And he kept telling me these things, and I was filming him over time, you know, over a couple, you know, span of a couple months. And he one day laid out over 10,000 documents on my table and said, hey, look through it, see if I'm a conspiracy theorist. And I started to go through all these documents and found out shortly that there was a huge cover-up. There was a lot of really shady things that the city did, much that the families did not know about. And they had ways of getting around it. I don't want to give too much away because it's in the film, but there were ways of them getting around what they did. And it's highly illegal. And it's all laid out in the film. And the beauty of it is, it's not just us saying it. It's not us making an accusation against the city. There is physical documentation supporting everything that we mentioned in the film. If we talk about something the city did, we show it on paper. We show their own words written out with letterheads addressed to people, signed, showing that they did these things. And it's unbelievable. I can't believe we're talking about pioneers. We're talking about immigrants. We're talking about people that came to this country to make a better lives for themselves. And their last place, their last resting place, which was a huge part of the 1800s, the 1900s, these people really believed in death and life after death. And graves and their final resting place to them is sacred. And that was completely ripped out and taken from them by the city. And we show that and showcase that in the film. And you'll see some documents in there that'll just really piss you the hell off if you have a conscience.
So do you still live in the community? Do you get interesting reactions from the community? Or are you?
I do live in the community. I live not far from the cemetery still. The film has not been released. It's only been screened 3 times. So the film has not been released to the public. And it's looking at a 2021 release date. I'm still working on that. We'll see how that goes. As everyone knows in the entertainment industry, things could change very quickly. Yep. But we're looking at a 2021 release date, and I'm talking with a few different distributors about getting that film out there. And I think once the city gets the heat, I think that they're going to have to address it in some way, shape, or form, especially now, especially the climate we're in these days. And there's a lot of controversy in Ventura right now, you know, and so there's people that have lived here for 40 years that have no idea what happened. So I think that once this is exposed and once people understand, I think it's going to change a few things.
Well, I mean, even being my hometown, I was born and raised there, lived near Cemetery Park for years, I had no idea. I thought it was just a fun name as well. And so it honestly, and this sounds terrible on my part, I know this, but it took you telling me about this. And I, you know, I was very lucky to be able to watch the film through film festivals. And it's kind of life-changing when you actually think about how easy it was for them to cover it up. And it makes you wonder, like, what is being covered up around us otherwise? Because this was huge and this affected so, so many people. And a lot of people still don't know yet and won't know until that this film is released.
Exactly. That's another thing that's an interesting portion of this film, is that it's not only the city that's culpable. The Catholic Church was right there with them, involved in the whole thing. So you'll see that play out in the film. You'll see how it comes together. And it's heartbreaking, man. It is hard to watch. And one thing is, being a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker, you have to remain as unbiased as possible. Like, it's really hard not to get emotionally invested in those situations. And that's why it was hard for me not only to go in and hear about this, and kind of, it's all unfolding to me as the film's being made. So I'm kind of seeing it as it's happening almost in real time, at least the way I learned. But the biggest thing to me was actually showing these documents that, you know, Steve got through a Freedom of Information Act, you know, which is because the city of Ventura is a corporation and is using taxpayer dollars to operate. Those documents are our property as well. So through the Freedom of Information Act, Steve got these documents, and it's really condemning to the city and highly, highly illegal. So there's one portion in the film and one document in particular that is the smoking gun that takes it that extra step to show how illegal it was. And it's signed by the city, letterhead and all. It's right there in front of our faces. And it's crazy because Steve never saw that document. There's so many of them that I found that document and I set up, you know, time to film with Steve. I handed the document to him on camera, had him read it and got his take, you know, in real time on the film. And that's a huge moment. It's pretty unbelievable.
Well, to add to the enraging feelings that I'm feeling is the fact that Ventura County and my brother lives in Santa Barbara. He's been there for 20 years. That whole area is historically so inspired by Hispanic culture. And you mentioned the immigrants. I mean, I would imagine most of that cemetery were probably people of color that were buried and just forgotten about.
100%. You're right. You're 100% right. You have the Catholic faith. You have the Jewish faith. You have the Protestant faith. You have so over 3,000 of these people. This was one time was, you know, Mexican occupied California. It was Mexico at that time. And then once that transition started to be made where, you know, it was part of the United States, it was all people of color out here. I mean, we're talking about a city named San Buenaventura. This place was all people from all over the world, Italy, Spain. I mean, you can, anywhere you can imagine, you could throw a dart at a map and I'm sure it's going to hit a place that someone came from and is now interred in a desecrated cemetery.
So it's like the sequel to like Poltergeist.
That's actually funny you bring that up. Some say that Poltergeist was actually, Cemetery Park was the influence for that idea for Poltergeist, you know, so that's been floated around a lot.
I could see that. And there's also, I think it was Denver Airport. Every time I went into Denver Airport, they were talking about like how there's all these ghostly activities because it was just built on a graveyard or cemetery plot for Native Americans. So stop building stuff on graveyards.
Yeah, especially that's another thing about Cemetery Memorial Park or, you know, a cemetery that's there. St. Mary's is what it was called at one time. There was a lot of, it was originally a Native American gravesite, you know, and that's would be an obvious place for them to continue to bury people, right? So they're like, okay, the people that were here before us and are continuing to be here, this is where they bury their dead. So we'll continue to bury people here as well. So there's every faith, every creed, every skin color, they're all there. They're all there. And they're all now in a disrespected state. I guess that's the way I can put it.
To follow up that point, have you done an investigation? I would imagine.
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
I would imagine it has to be active when, you know, you have so many graves that you mentioned were desecrated. I could only think it's just hopping.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of stories because, you know, I've been involved with the paranormal field so long and I've been a filmmaker as well. I wanted to kind of separate those two things and do a film that was not paranormal related, more true crime. So I didn't touch on any of the paranormal stuff. I never dabbled into investigating it from that perspective. But all of the apartment buildings surrounding the cemetery, all of them claim to have activity. All of them, every single one. So I've heard a lot of stories about people experiencing paranormal phenomena around the cemetery. And I experienced a lot in my apartment building, which is right next to it. I could literally, I would look out my window every morning and look at that cemetery. And I had a lot of experiences. So but I never actually investigated it myself, but there's a lot of people that claim to have some pretty crazy stuff happen.
I was going to say, before we get into it, I have to say that I've been friends with Brandon for a very, very, very long time. And before we go into everything that you guys are doing, I just have to ask, what's it been like working with Brandon? Because I did Ghost Hunters 7, 8 years ago now. And I've known Brandon for probably close to 10 years now. And it's so exciting seeing him on the show and doing all these different things. And what's this experience like for you? Because you met him on the show. Is that right?
I met him at pretty much casting, you know, they I didn't really know if I wanted to go and do it. And like I went out there and, you know, they had us there for like a week and they made us take psychological evaluations. And I don't know how the hell I passed that. And then we did like a whole bunch of other stuff. And, you know, we were going through it the whole week. And the biggest thing I was kind of just concerned with was what's my take on things. I just want to say what I want to say. I don't want to try to do something to get on the show to get them to like me, because, you know, like, I don't want to do that. Like, fuck you. Like, I'm not going to just go and be your dancing monkey, because that's how I've like ruined my whole life doing that. So I was like, I'm not going to do it. So I literally went out there just to like put myself in a pressurized situation and whatever. I didn't care. at that point if I got the show. But what was really cool was while we were screen testing, Brandon was smart. Like, I kind of got that, like, a lot of people were there and they were like, you could tell people were nervous and you kind of get in that mentality of like, ooh, let me go to other people for comfort. And I was kind of like a dick. Like, I wasn't talking to anybody and I would like shoot down stuff that they would say. And, you know, I wouldn't really entertain their jokes. I wouldn't laugh. And I would just say things that I just wanted to entertain myself when I was out there.
Damn.
And as a result, I kind of like, you know, got put what I wanted to say on the record, but I was doing my best work. So Brandon and I, he's like that. He's kind of like, I don't give a crap who you are, where you're from. All and
as
like,
long as you love me,
pretty much, yeah, exactly. He's a huge Backstreet Boys fan. So I don't know if you guys know about him. Yeah, he himself is responsible for 100 of the records sold to get them to triple platinum in 3 weeks.
He's the reason.
He is the reason, 100%. But yeah, so it was interesting because I remember the head producer, Mike Nichols, executive producer, and I promise this is gonna like make sense.
Mike was my producer too, so keep going.
Oh yeah, Mike's, he looks like a combination of Stephen King and Mark Summers from
shit.
You know what
that's
I mean,
exactly, like, what he looks like. Yeah,
face mash with Stephen King and Mark Summers. But so Mike's looking around and he's looking at people to pair with to go on screen, and like I'm standing here and then Brandon's standing here, and then Brandon kind of just looks at me and like I see out of my peripheral, he kind of just like moves closer to me because he knew we kind of had like a good vibe. And then Mike's like, yeah, you two go. So then we went and we investigated together, and it was the first time, it was probably the first time I ever got direct feedback from what I thought was a paranormal entity, like in my 15 years of investigating, like the first time ever. And I don't know if it had to do with like whatever vibe or energy that like Brandon and I had together, but we were so just very focused on, all right, these are the claims here. Let's look into it. Let's try to like really connect with the entities and, you know, acknowledging the fact that like, you know, the people here, they're like late 1800s Spaniards who migrated to California. There's no way some scumbag from New Jersey and some like, you know, dude from, you know, maybe Brandon a little bit more than me because, you know, he grew up with like in California at least. But like, there's no way I'm going to like be able to. So I went there and then, you know, started speaking a little bit of Spanish that I knew and stuff. And then all of a sudden we started getting like feedback. And Kendall, you know, Ashley, you know Kendall, mm-hmm. right? Kendall, who's like an amazing investigator in his own way. He's there. He's like, what the fuck? Like, while we're doing it. So I was like, oh, this is cool. So it ended up being like an incredible investigation. Like, that could have made the show. It was great. And yeah, from then on, it was just, I love the guy, man. Like, I talk with him every single day, multiple times a day. We're like this now, like it's, and that was from day one, like very, very cool. So very fortunate to have met him, and he's completely changed the way I work. He's extremely, he pushes you to like do more and more and more. And, you know, he sets a high bar. So yeah, he's fantastic. He's my bro.
That's something that I've told people before, and anybody that listens to the show knows, like, I've been friends with Brandon for a long time, but when I first started into the paranormal field, like, he was my mentor. He was the person that I looked up to in every single way, because I had met him when I was first starting off in this. And like, anytime I had an EVP where I was like, I need someone that is credible and legitimate and I need them to hear this, it was always Brandon, and it's always been Brandon. And so it's really exciting because like, I've seen what, I don't have TV, so I can only see Ghost Hunters once in a while when I can.
Yeah.
What I have seen though is what you guys are doing, and I'm so excited to see the science end of this just become like the forefront of what we're doing. And of all the people in the world that I knew was going to be able to do this, I knew Brandon was going to be able to be a face of that. And so, you know, it's exciting in every single way. So I am very happy that you're on the show today. I really appreciate it, because it just feels like I'm talking to another extension of Brandon at this point. So
that's a high compliment.
Well, speaking of which, not only are you and Brandon partners on Ghost Hunters, you're about to be partners in business, if you will. Congratulations. You have a publishing deal with Llewellyn Worldwide. We're coming out early next year. So what can you tell us about this book?
We've been writing this thing probably since the Pillars Estate investigation from season one. what we can tell you is that, just like Ashley said, it's heavily steeped in science, investigative protocol, how to minimize false positives, along with deeper looks into a lot of the cases that were on Ghost Hunters, more of the history, things that didn't make TV that were like crazy, and we have a lot of like data for, and how to, and a lot of interesting theories and like a lot of correlations that were made between new introduction to new devices like the EMCCD camera, the electron multiplying camera, along with advances in the correlation between the EMCCD and our data loggers, right? So what do those theories mean? So we were actually able to tie in a lot of theories with from physicists like Sir Roger Penrose, right? And we noticed that like these theories actually apply to our findings, which is really, really cool. So it's super scientific and nerdy in that way. But we also have a lot of like good like ghost stories and stuff in it too. So yeah, like I want to crack jokes about it and stuff, but like it's I can't, like it's so we've worked like so hard on it, and it's really, really awesome. We have a similar work ethic, so yeah, people can expect to see a lot of behind the scenes stuff, along with some really new interesting theories that'll hopefully change the way people investigate for the better. And maybe, you know, and Brandon's actually working on a really cool like rubric. So it's like a thing. It's like, oh, if you're starting out to investigate, okay, consider this. So like you can have a sheet, you can go in and fill that out, or, you know, have a PDF on your phone or whatever, and you can go and fill that out. So yeah,
that's we're so cool. I feel like you need to make an app though.
I feel like from what Brandon was telling me is it is, and I don't, please don't think that I'm down this at all. I'm really excited, but it's kind of like a ghost hunting for dummies kind of thing where you guys explain like how to do things and how to actually investigate properly though. Like you go through the actual, here's what's right, here's what's wrong, here's techniques you can use. Like, is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of like, it's like, in terms of like here's what's right, here's what's wrong. I think like it's, you hit the nail on the head in terms of like, how do you push the field forward in terms of actual evidence and actual science? And I think evidence should be used for everything. Like, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You got some like deadbeat boyfriend or girlfriend at home. It's like, I love you. It's like, well, you don't even get off the freaking couch and like do anything for me. It's like, fuck you. You know, it's like, I don't care. You can love me inside all you want, but like go and do something. All right. Buy me a goddamn, you know, chocolate bar or something. I don't know. But like, it's whatever. If that's like the bare minimum, and I would be very happy with it. I hope my wife hears this right now.
And now we're a love advice column. Congratulations. Yeah.
He's just basically asking his wife for a candy bar on air. That's all he's doing.
Still wait.
What chapter book is that?
That is chapter 69. That's
chapter. Of course. Are you It's a really big book.
Nah, they're like 8-page chapters. But so I think it's like, it just in terms of evidence, like look for the evidence, document your evidence, and eradicate any kind of false positives. And then like, don't go and use equipment that you don't know. Like I've seen boxes where it's like, hey, this light turns on, that means there's a ghost. I'll be like, well, what does it measure? They're like, it's a ghost light. Like, okay, like, it's a ghost light. I'll be like, all right, well, thanks, but I don't want to put that on the show. Like, I'm not going to just put a ghost light on the show. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So that's the thing, is we're trying to take it out of the realm of pseudoscience and really measure, okay, these are the environmental changes. This happens when like, you know, you start talking about this, and this is what we can document. So, you know, it's definitely not as cool as being like, oh my God, like, you know, some demon just licked my butthole. But now I could be like, well, I felt the lick on my anus while there was a drop in pressure.
And it's also on page 69, by the way, or chapter 69.
That's actually the DVD extra.
Now you can scientifically measure that.
That is the DVD extras ghost hunters. Yeah. So you guys will see that.
All I want in my life is to be able to scientifically measure a succubus. And I feel like that's what you're doing here. Thank you.
Sorry, ever since I played Darkstalkers.
Well, the funny thing is, like, we had Brandon Alves on probably about 6 weeks ago. And I actually knows him well. I've never met him before. But you can see how truly scientific he is, because he is so low key that he's always just even keel. And he... I could tell the book was going to be great because when we were talking about it, even he got excited. Like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brandon's the kind of guy where he could win a $3 million lottery and just go, oh, there's a benefit to this. Yeah, okay, I see that. That's okay, let me correlate after the taxes. Yeah, okay, you know what? I think I could benefit from this. But like talking about the book, you could tell he was pumped.
Yeah. He's actually, that's the thing is like, he's extremely, extremely, extremely professional. But when it comes to things that are, I've seen him, you know, I've been on the road with him and stuff. He gets really passionate about things that he cares about. And he will be very passionate to defend certain ideologies and certain people. He's defended me a lot of times on the road in certain instances. And I really, really appreciate that. But he's somebody who's just always about, okay, cool. Let's meet in the work. That's what I like about him is like, there's no need to be like, oh, you're my friend. You're my best friend. Ooh, just like that. It's just like, no, just, let's do the actions of what a best friend does. And you're my best friend. Like, that's it. Like, I don't need to tell you that you're like, you know, we're friends, but that's how we feel. Like, we just do the work. And then we met each other in the work. And the second I think one of us ever falls off, you know, we would definitely tell each other, be like, what the hell, man? Like, you know, I'm getting lazy or doing this and hasn't come to that. But I mean, yeah, we've been crushing it with the book and everything and really ahead of schedule. So yeah, it should be out soon, sooner than later. I think our publisher is going to be happy.
Yeah. I feel like when it comes to investigations, and maybe not everybody feels this way, but there was a person that I used to investigate with pretty consistently, and Brandon knows them. And when I would investigate with her specifically, it was very, we would have a lot more interaction. We would have a lot more evidence. And it was very, it felt very twin soul in that way. And yeah. I think that's what you guys have in this case. Like, you naturally came together. You naturally get the evidence that, you know, you guys have been working towards. And that creates a really good business and partnership in general. And I just, it's really interesting and really great to see that it happens to more people than just who I was investigating with.
It's cool. I'm very, very fortunate to have met him that way. And if I didn't get the show, I would have definitely hit him up even afterwards and wanted to work with him and investigate with him. I remember coming home and talking about my wife and, you know, I knew I had done great, like the auditions, the talking, all that stuff. I said everything I needed to say. I felt fantastic. I was on cloud nine, and I didn't even know I was going to take the show until like 3 days before I flew out. Like, I didn't sign the contract until like they kept pressing me, and I was like, you know, because I took a pay cut to do it because I was doing so many other things, and I had to turn down like a bunch of like terrorist roles in like New York that paid a lot of money. It's like, oh, is it like terrorist number nine? It's like, you know, you go.
Who's going to play terrorist number nine now?
A lot of life.
That's very pilgrim, though, to be like, "Yeah, we don't know when we're sending you. Oh, we're sending you in 2 days. Goodbye. Good luck."
They were a little better than from the reputation I heard with us, but yeah, there's some crazy stuff that happened. But yeah, they were they let me know and they kept pressing me. I talked with Mike. It was Mike who really kind of like, you know, solidified it for me. And then I was like, "All right, cool." And then I decided to do it. I wouldn't have it any other way. And I remember telling Miriam, I was like, they don't put Brandon on the show. I was like, I'm not even going to watch it. It's like, there's no point. Cause he was clearly, when we were out there, like he was clearly like a cut above, I think everybody who was at the casting, he knew exactly what he was talking about. I remember we were setting stuff up and, you know, I knew a little bit because I had worked with my tech guy on my home team. We're not talking anymore. He got pissed that I got the show. But I remember Brandon was there. Everybody's on set. And then we're all there. And then, like, they're setting stuff up. And everybody just looks at Brandon. What do we do now? And I was like, okay, cool. Like, that tells you everything you need to know.
Well, with the book, I imagine you guys are going to go over the correlation between, you know, pressure and light anomalies. Kind of explain that in a little bit so we can understand it. I'm sure Ashley and Anastasia do. I'll be honest, I might not quite understand it. So
yeah. Okay. So there is a positive correlation that we have documented on several instances that whenever there is a light phenomena that is registered on the EMCCD camera, where a light source is being generated from energy out of nowhere. It's not like, oh, this is somebody shining a flashlight or, oh, there's a bug going on this. There's a light source. There's nothing there. And then there's a formation of some energy source. Whenever that happens, there are changes in barometric pressure. So what does this tell us, right? Okay. So I started looking into the correlations between light and pressure. And the biggest correlation between light and pressure happens in a black hole. The last thing to survive in a black hole is light. After that light sucked through, whatever matter or energy is there is done, comes out the other side, and it is transformed into something else. So black holes destroy a lot of things, but they also create new life out the other side, whatever that is. So what does that tell us? One, okay, black holes, they thrive in high pressure environments. So are we looking at a weird moment in time that is akin to a black hole phenomenon, because time stands still in a black hole, or there's like a change in time? So when we're experiencing a paranormal event, are we looking into a moment in time? Like, are we not talking to a ghost? Are we talking to someone or activating a weird moment in time where we're not talking to a ghost, but somebody actually alive in 1913 or somebody in, you know, 1680, and we're just talking to them then? Or due to the law of thermodynamics, where matter is neither created nor destroyed, when we die, do we turn into a photon event or a light anomaly? And what is left of us is that a light anomaly, right? And why do some people, if that's the case, why do some people become light anomalies and others don't? You know, there's interesting things about like our like genetic structure changes depending on the lives that we live. Like the if you become an athlete, you are literally changing your genetic structure over the course of 10 years of consistent, crazy, like working out. If I like Usain Bolt, let's say, like he has a kid, that kid is more genetically predisposed to being better, not just because of like genetics, but because of the way he worked out to be a better athlete. So I wonder if the way people live their lives, does that have something to do with how their being, whatever that is kind of retained after they die? I don't know. Yeah.
You're saying it's a possibility of, let's say someone is a great athlete or in very good physical condition for the majority of their life. Is that how maybe a possibility of them being more likely to be visible or make a presence after death, whereas other people might not be as likely? Is am I way off on that? Or is that like,
I'm talking about just like, let's say you're a kind of person who is somebody who, by the way they live their life, similar to how an athlete like lives an athletic life, and then they will pass on their genes that are now athletic genes, is the way somebody, how they live their life, whatever that is, I have no idea what that is, but the way they live their life, does that make them more prone to becoming a light anomaly or persisting in a way that we can communicate with after they die? I have no idea. I don't know if that has something to do with trauma or deep feeling or the way somebody lived their life or extreme happiness and love or whatever that is. That's getting all hippy dippy, but I do
like
think
a Care Bear,
like a Care Bear, or so, you know, I don't know,
or like glowing up, you know.
Can I ask? So, when you've done these experiments so far,
yeah,
you guys are, you've already conducted these. Have you found that they, who responds more, residual or intelligent hauntings? Like, what are you feeling that you're getting the most response from? Because there's such a different experience every time. And I'm just curious as to who is the one that is responding to what you're doing.
I have to look to specific cases. I think a lot of it has to do with honesty, as weird as this sounds, like respect and honesty. Mm-hmm. And I think the two go hand in hand. Like if you're not trying to, you know how messed up it is, like how much it sucks when somebody's trying to bullshit you in a situation just in life. Like, you know, like somebody's trying to like come up to you and like, you can tell when someone's just trying to become your friend so they can get something from you. Like, you know, it's like, get out of here, man. Like, I know, like you can see it from a mile away. If you live in any major city and somebody's coming up to say hi to you, it's like, you just know when they're going to start asking you for $5 or like whatever, just so they can get something to eat. And it's like, ugh. So I think a lot of times too, when I address that for the show, we got some of our best interactions. You know, when I kind of address the elephant in the room, we got our best interactions. Like, hey, I know we're here with all these cameras and we're kind of, and I should feel disgusting because I'm asking you to dance in front of the camera for me like a monkey or whatever. But like, could you please, like, you know, I really just want to know what was going on with you? What happened? Does this mean anything to you? Da, da, da. And then that's what really kind of got our best reactions. It happened in Worley Hospital in Pampa, Texas. They didn't show it in an episode because there's not enough time, but like we had like a 20, almost 24 minute long back and forth where like someone was turning a motion detector on and off. And we wrote about this in the book, but you know, it was a nurse it's the only time I'm ever sure I knew who I was talking to. Her name's Mary Lucille Myers. She had tried to commit suicide twice in a day. Her husband had come back from World War II. He was in a POW camp and then things were not good at home. And you know, Texas in the 40s, it's not like you're gonna go get a divorce. You know, she thought this guy was like great or whatever and things weren't good. Anyway, she tried to kill herself and she succeeded the second time by cyanide poisoning. And while we're there, motion detector gets turned on, stays on. So we're like, excuse me, kids, like if you're turning that on, could you step away from it? Because, and then step back if you want to answer yes, then the light starts to dim. So Brandon and I are like, oh. We start back and forth, motion detector's getting turned on. But then when we're going back and reviewing the audio, after we ask, like, oh, excuse me, could you step away from that, please? You hear a woman say, oh, sorry, and step away from it.
Oh.
And it's like,
she's so light. I love her.
Yeah. And it was
you answer your own question without answering it. It sounds like it's intelligent that responds to this theory that you're talking about.
Yeah, we've had a lot of intelligent hauntings. Like there's crazy stuff. Like, you know, Alaska, Daryl's standing where him and I are in the hallway. And then like I start experiencing exactly what one of the witnesses did. And I'm like kind of pissed because like, God damn it. Like, I hope we pick up something on our, you know, devices. I'm like, because everybody's going to think I'm just playing this up for camera. And then Daryl's like, yeah, it's like, I feel a tension in my lower back. So we're going to review the audio. Before Daryl says, I feel a tension in my lower back, you hear like a deeper old man's voice say, I feel a tension in my lower back. And then that same, and it predicted what Daryl was going to say or influenced him. They didn't put that in the show, but they did put like when Daryl got charged by what he thought was an app, like somebody charging him, you hear that same voice go, it's me. Somebody walking through the hallway. And then he caught like on his body cam, like a full body apparition looking once, twice, and then like move. Yeah.
Well, speaking of physicality, I mean, the episode I want to discuss, it happened to you at the Glenn House. I mean, you got marked up. And you and Brandon, you talk about, Ashley mentioned you guys having that good chemistry. My God, you guys were really successful at the Glenn House. And there's something about families that were well off and have a tragic end that they just never leave. And you guys got a lot of action that night.
You're rich.
Yeah. I it's actually funny. I mean, to me, I kind of owe my own family losing our house to getting the show. We grew up in a haunted house. We ended up like losing it because we couldn't afford it anymore. It was something like I'll never forget. Like to this day, like we're trying to buy a new house, like me and my wife. And you know, like every time I think about it, I start getting like, oh no, it's like PTSD from it because it's like the worst feeling in the world. But that's the kind of thing that sticks with you. You know what I mean? You're haunted by that. So I think for me, I know Grant and the show was like, it could be a positive thing because we found in that episode where I got scratched, there was a letter written by Sarah Glenn Marsh, a descendant of the Glenn family, who said that, you know, love was built into the foundation of the Glenn House. And, you know, very well could be a very positive thing. And that just whoever's there is trying to alert me to it. That's fine. But to me, again, this is just a theory and it's a feeling. I kind of felt like it was more like a, hey man, like, fuck you. You know what this feels like. Like, why would you bring that up? And I did it in a way to kind of, I didn't do it in a good way. I did it in a way to like entice somebody to come and like, you know, to try to incite activity. And I was like, well, you know, if you know, this isn't your house anymore, like, you know, you're going to have to get out. It belongs to Christy now. So that's when it happened after I said that. And I think, again, it's that honesty thing. It's like, what the hell is wrong with you? You know how traumatic it is to lose a house and you're going to like freaking basically do what the enemy did. Like, you know, you're a scumbag, dude. Like, you know what this feels like. So yeah, I felt kind of grimy.
And not to mention the family went through financial ruin before essentially all dying. So yeah, kind of, I would imagine whoever is still there, probably a little salty.
Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't. I'd be salty too. I'd be like, screw you, man. This house meant everything to me. And we wrote about the house in the book, and dude, like the house was like the first one with like indoor plumbing on the block. It was like a crazy house. There were the Joneses to keep up with. That William Howard Taft came and like visited the house, saw the family. Their daughter was like riding on a boat with the president. So they were like a big deal, man. They were a big deal. They were like growing up Gotti in the heyday in the early 2000s.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed it, tell a couple of friends and please rate and review the show on whatever platform you're listening on, especially if it's iTunes and Apple Podcasts. We appreciate you.